It is Thursday, February 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump says he will visit the site of the Florida school shooting where 17 people died. South Africa has a new president, and the new movie Black Panther is set to break the box office. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump says he'll visit Parkland, Florida, the site of Wednesday's shooting that killed 17 people. Trump said from the White House he's making plans to meet with families and local officials and to continue coordinating the federal response. Trump called on Americans to answer hate with love, answer cruelty with kindness, after a troubled 19-year-old former pupil gunned down students and teachers at the school.
Our entire nation, with one heavy heart, is praying for the victims and their families. To every parent, teacher, and child who is hurting so badly, we are here for you, whatever you need, whatever we can do to ease your pain. We are all joined together as one American family, and your suffering is our burden also. No child, no teacher should ever be in danger in an American school. No parent should ever have to fear for their sons and daughters when they kiss them goodbye in the morning. Each person who was stolen from us yesterday had a full life ahead of them, a life filled with wondrous beauty and unlimited potential and promise. Each one had dreams to pursue, love to give, and talents to share with the world. And each one had a family to whom they meant everything in the world.
The troubled 19-year-old man accused of the latest mass shooting in the U.S. is expected to make his first court appearance on Thursday. Authorities have charged Nicholas Cruz with 17 counts of premeditated murder. Trump said the investigation will continue.
Our administration is working closely with local authorities to investigate the shooting and learn everything we can. We are committed to working with state and local leaders to help secure our schools and tackle the difficult issue of mental health. Later this month, I will be meeting with the nation's governors and attorney generals. We're making our schools and our children safer will be our top priority.
Police arrested Cruz outside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, about 70 kilometers north of Miami. Florida Governor Rick Scott spoke at a news conference Thursday.
We're going to have a real conversation about two things. How do we make sure when a parent is ready to send their child to school that in Florida that parent knows that child is going to be safe? Number two, how do we make sure that individuals with mental illness do not touch a gun?
Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie praised two of the teachers who saved students.
I want to acknowledge some heroes that have been in our schools. We had an athletic director, campus monitor, who responded immediately when there were signs of trouble in school. Fortunately, those two heroes gave their lives for our kids and probably helped prevent this from being a worse tragedy than it is today.
The Miami Herald quoted a teacher who said Cruz had threatened other students last year.
This is Science in a Minute.
Businesses and local governments located in areas where it snows a lot must make sure that the white stuff is kept clear from their streets, sidewalks, and parking lots. The problem in some cases is what to do with all the snow that's been cleared. The snow may be pushed into gigantic piles where it is left to melt naturally, or it's taken to disposal sites where they use gas-powered heaters to melt it. But that can take a lot of time or use up valuable space and energy. Researchers who've authored a study published in the American Chemical Society's journal Langmuir say they may have a solution. They have found that sunlight-absorbing thermal blankets made of aluminum alloy and painted black on each side melts snow 3 times faster than it would if it were left alone to melt naturally. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Pakistan slams a U.S. intelligence threat assessment, saying it smacks of partisanship. Britain is poised to impose direct rule over Northern Ireland. Ethiopia's prime minister submits a resignation, and the U.S. Senate awaits a vote on immigration reform. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the new film Black Panther awaits movie audiences. South Africa's parliament formally chose Cyril Ramaphosa as the country's new president Thursday. Ramaphosa was elected without a vote, as he was the only candidate nominated in the parliament in Cape Town. Ramaphosa's election came hours after Jacob Zuma resigned with immediate effect, just days after leaders of the ruling African National Congress decided to recall him after his 9-year tenure marred by allegations of corruption and economic stagnation. VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell speaks with me from Johannesburg.
So it was a real festive, kind of lighthearted occasion in Parliament. We haven't seen that in a while, especially not during the very, very combative Zuma years. So it was there was a lot of pomp, and Cyril Ramaphosa was the only nominee. He was nominated by his party, the African National Congress, and it did not need to go to a vote because he was the only nominee. It was seconded, and the Chief Justice said, okay, fine, it's going to be Cyril Ramaphosa. He's the new president-elect of South Africa. So he is now the president. He was put on notice a little bit by opposition parties who said, we will hold you accountable, we will continue to challenge you. But overall, the mood was really hopeful, I would say, after 9 years of such despair, I think, among the opposition and so much contention and tension in the ANC and in Parliament.
Well, Ramaphosa after Jacob Zuma resigned. Now, it seemed like that happened sort of suddenly, because it seemed like yesterday, at least, that he didn't want to resign.
Right. So when Zuma addressed the nation last night, and you recall it was about 10:30 at night, so 90 minutes before his putative midnight deadline, he explained that, and he's correct about this, that the ANC never gave him a particular accounting of what they believe he did wrong. They just said, you need to go. And he said that as a loyal member of the ANC, he felt it was important to honor the recall. He also said, for the record, I guess to make the point, that he said he was not afraid or embarrassed by a no-confidence vote, and he respected the parliament. But he also did avoid that fate by stepping out of that and just resigning.
I guess you hinted at this a bit earlier. The opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party staged a walkout before the vote regarding Mr. Ramaphosa, and I believe they have called for early elections. Is that likely at all?
They are not. The Economic Freedom Fighters are not the only party that have called for early elections, and they say they're referring to Article 50 of the Constitution that says when there is a resignation, there should be a dissolution of parliament and snap elections. However, let's remember that parliament is 62% controlled by the African National Congress. So if they approach Parliament, if the opposition approaches Parliament, they will need members of the ANC to cross the aisle and vote with them on that. And this new, united, optimistic ANC is probably not likely to do that.
Anita, I understand that Zuma's son is in legal trouble of his own.
Yes, one of Zuma's sons. Remember, Zuma has more than 20 known children. One of Zuma's older sons, he's in his early 30s, Dudu Zane, is currently being sought by the police in connection with a massive, large-scale corruption case. It also involves that family that has seen so many headlines in South Africa, the Gupta family. This is the Indian family that is accused of manipulating Jacob Zuma and infiltrating the South African government and exercising undue influence. And Duduzana Zuma was the head of their computer organization, Sahara Computers. And so he is also being sought by police as we speak, along with one of the Gupta brothers, Ajay, who's also on the run. The other brother's in custody, Atul. He was seized after he attempted to leave South Africa on a private jet, and the pilot refused to take off.
That's VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan Thursday said more than 10,000 civilians were killed or wounded in violence in Afghanistan last year, with nearly 2,300 of them the result of militant bombings, including suicide attacks. In all, more than 3,400 were killed in 2017, with more than 7,000 wounded. While the overall figure represents a 9% decline in casualties from 2016, it's also the largest number killed or wounded by militant bombings than in any previous year. The figures were released as the Taliban insurgency made public a rambling 3,000-word letter to the American people, offering dialogue as a way to end America's longest conflict in exchange for an end to what it called the American occupation and acceptance of a Taliban government. Nazif Shahrani, an Afghan-born professor of anthropology and Central and Middle Eastern cultures at Indiana University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, one way to look at it is the Taliban, even in power, had no policy agenda other than killing.
So I don't think there is anything in the letter that could tell us, even if America withdrew, how they might govern or they would even have the capability to govern. The other way of reading it is, I think this letter is not so much what Taliban wanted to say or write, but what their sponsors, the ISI in Pakistan, have become perhaps desperate and tried to communicate through them that they are not sponsors of the Taliban and that they are under pressure, obviously, by the current government in the United States. And I think this is the Pakistanis' way of saying something to the administration here. Perhaps they want to negotiate instead of Taliban. Taliban are not an entity for any government, in fact, except maybe the Kabul regime, which is also in a very shaky mood right now. This might be a more likely call.
What about the timing of this letter, if you will? Is it tied to any event or series of events?
I think the Pakistanis are desperate. They are isolated. They're under pressure. They have started a war of sorts in Kashmir with India. And that this is a desperate call, maybe more by Pakistanis than the Taliban. And Taliban are also under pressure, I think, militarily anyway, that the activities, U.S. Military activity in Afghanistan has increased.
Well, it came after some high-profile attacks in and around Kabul that have left hundreds dead, suggesting the Taliban is stronger than ever.
It's not so much Taliban are stronger than ever, it's the government in Kabul is weaker than ever.
Should the U.S. dismiss this letter, or should it take it seriously?
It needs to be taken at face value. It's another attempt by Taliban, who are playing, I think, the media quite well. They could say, we're not negotiating with Taliban, but we are willing to negotiate with the sponsors. You remember, there is a precedent. Even during the 1980s, in negotiations to bring about Soviet withdrawal, Mujahideen were not included in the discussion. It was the Pakistanis and the Americans who negotiated with the Kabul regime and with the Soviets.
That's Nazif Shahrani of Indiana University. A U.S. State Department official said the Taliban statement alone does not show a willingness to engage in peace talks. Its recent terrorist attacks in Kabul speak louder than words in the letter. These attacks show the Taliban, according to the State Department, is not ready to negotiate. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Ryan Coogler's superhero film Black Panther, based on the Marvel comic, is about a king of a technology-advanced African country. His superb fighting skills are enhanced by his mystical powers and vibranium-crafted Black Panther suit. The film, which cost more than $200 million to make, has created a buzz worldwide for its cinematography, special effects, great cast, and especially its homage to African culture. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more. Let's go.
The story is set in Wakanda, a small fictional African nation that hides a big secret. Built on vibranium, the Earth's strongest metal, Wakanda has the technology and power no other nation has ever seen.
Determines what happens to the rest of the world.
After his father dies in a terrorist attack, T'Challa, played by Chadwick Boseman, assumes powers of the Black Panther and becomes the new king. Filmmaker Ryan Coogler has created a contemporary African superhero.
What makes the Black Panther the Black Panther? And obviously, you got the political responsibility. You know, you got the suit. You know, you got the claws. You know, you got the strength. We got the fact that he's African. Like, that's the thing that makes him unique.
The film raises the risks and benefits of an advanced country's political isolationism. Should Wakanda share its power and technology with the rest of the world, or hide and protect its resources from outsiders?
It is my responsibility to make sure that Wakanda does not fall into the hands of a person like you.
The film's storyline and black superhero have captivated the imagination of audiences worldwide, says Lupita Nyong'o. She plays Nakia, a Wakandan spy and T'Challa's love interest.
We have here a Marvel universe that is unapologetically black, and to see us occupy an African country with kings and queens and warriors, and it's so inspiring. It's an aspirational nation that really just kind of is rejuvenating to the human spirit.
In a VOA interview, Black Panther producer Nate Moore and costume designer and Oscar nominee Ruth Carter said everyone on the film wanted to create a movie that showcased a proud, beautiful, and intelligent black culture.
Typically in cinema, when you see Africa, it tends to be stories about poverty and stories about resources being stripped. And here's the country that in our world is the most technologically advanced in the world. That's a great kind of an example to show to kids.
Carter's colorful garments reflect African tradition and empower its characters, especially the women.
Wakanda forever!
They are actual fighters. They are generals. They are. They have weaponry. They wear armor. But then we did it in a beautiful way, so the color is enhanced. The armor looks like jewelry. Their harness, as I call it, wraps the body in a certain way. They pay homage to their history.
Moore says the acting cast and the film's creators paid attention to every detail.
We went to great lengths and had cultural advisors, and a lot of our cast is from Africa. Even our dialect coach, Beth McGuire, McGuire and all of our cast members wanted to sound African. And again, at the same time, I think African-American audiences, there's a lot to pull from. And hopefully there's some inspiration, again, about learning about the roots of where African-Americans came from.
Show off.
At T.C. Williams, a racially diverse high school in Alexandria, Virginia, students are excited about the film.
I'm very excited. I feel like it gives a message to younger children or just our society in general that no one is born racist, and with this, you're sort of teaching them not to be.
I think it's super important for not only young women, but young black girls and young just black individuals to see this kind of representation in the media. And I think it'll give them a really big sense of empowerment.
But also show who we are as people and that we are superheroes in our own way. And that has been proven through like marches, black protests, that we are not just a minority, but we are a part of the majority.
Whether it's the film's messages about black pride or women's empowerment, this highly anticipated movie is also set to break the box office record in the superhero movie universe. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Sounds like quite a film, Black Panther. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As economic and political conditions continue to deteriorate in Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro has turned his sights on another target, national Catholic leaders who have raised their voices against the misery the corrupt Maduro government has visited on the Venezuelan people. Maduro has called for an investigation into clergymen who have been critical of the government, claiming they may be guilty of a crime under a law passed in November by the illegitimate National Constituent Assembly, made up almost exclusively of supporters of President Maduro. Among other measures, the so-called constitutional law against hatred, for peaceful coexistence, and tolerance punishes purveyors of messages of purported hate in broadcast and social media with penalties of up to 20 years in prison, and members of political organizations who spread supposed hate must be expelled. Human Rights Watch described the law as a clear threat to freedom of expression. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights said it could generate a strong intimidation effect incompatible with a democratic society. Using this law as a weapon against Venezuela's religious leaders is Maduro's latest attempt to silence any opposition to his regime. Maduro reportedly referred to Catholic clerics, whom local media said included Bishops Victor Hugo Basabe of San Felipe and Antonio Lopez Castillo of Barquisimeto, as devils in cassocks. He also said the Catholic Church in Venezuela was full of evil, poison, hatred, perversion, and slander. In 2017, Venezuelan bishops criticized the dismantling of constitutional order in the country, and they recently condemned the hastily announced elections Maduro insists must take place in April. U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, denounced Maduro's call for a criminal investigation of the two Catholic bishops who spoke out against hunger and corruption under the so-called anti-hate law. In a statement, she noted that Maduro's reign of violence, repression, corruption, and bankruptcy continues to punish the Venezuelan people. By targeting religious leaders who promote peace and provide hope for believers, the regime continues to show that it cares only for preserving its own power and cares nothing about the basic human rights and welfare of its citizens. We continue, Ambassador Haley said, to stand strongly with the Venezuelan people in their battle to restore their democracy in the face of a brutal dictator.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.